Agriculture, the Environment, and Natural Resources Finance Committee to order, please. Today is February 10th, and today will be hearing a presentation from AURI. Mr. Olson, come forward, please. And Executive Director Olson, could you give us, after your introductions, could you give us a short snippet on how we got, how AURI got to where you are today in the finance division from the 2003-2004 proceedings that we worked on your budget with you?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
okay.
So that some of the members, we don't have everybody here, but a couple of members will have a little more background on how we got to where we're at today, if you could, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have with me Max Norris and Dan Lemke, which Communications Department, Max, I was going to say the Technical Services. I also have the Director of Programs and Finance with me, Teresa Spate, which is in the audience. And if we get into any real technical questions on finance, I'm sure that she'll be able to answer those for you. Members of the committee and as Executive Director of AURI, we have enjoyed 15 years of service to the state of Minnesota that has been, with varying degrees of programs and various programs that we've had to develop and further add value to the commodities that we have that are produced on Minnesota farms. To cut things short and to get into some of the pieces, I'm not sure if your members would want to have a brief resume or a rundown of what the programs that we do and what we have at the present time, and then get into the finance area, or how you would proceed on that.
That would be fine, Mr. Olson, if you wanted to proceed in that fashion.
Okay. Well, with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and as I mentioned before, mine to identify for the record, my name is Edgar Olson. I'm Executive Director of the Ag Utilization Research Institute. It's my pleasure to talk to you today and to be with you and to tell you how AURI adds value to Minnesota agriculture. Minnesota is very dependent on the health of agriculture and the ag processing industries. Over the course of 15-year history, AURI has successfully partnered with hundreds of existing and rural startups to help further opportunities in rural Minnesota. Producers in the state are also dependent upon the revenue streams that are created by value-added opportunities. Gone are the days when a farmer can simply sell their commodities to the local elevator and expect to make a living. Today, numerous farmers also invest in value-added enterprises designed to convert their farm commodities into higher-value products and ingredients. AURI is proud to have played a role in the development of many of these successful innovations. AURI assistance comes most frequently when it is most beneficial. During the early stages of a project and project development, it is at this time that the crucial decisions have to be made whether to discontinue the project or how to best proceed. With that, I'm going to have Dan Lemke present to you a little bit about what we've done as an organization, and going on from there, Max will be in the technical service area, and then if any questions you have, and then we'll probably define somewhat, and we did a report to the legislature last year on how the changes in financing and how that has occurred and how that happened to us from the 2003 report. So any further questions after that, we'd be happy to answer.
Mr. Lemke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Edgar mentioned, AURI is a very unique organization throughout Minnesota, basically created to identify and expand the markets for new and existing commodities, to develop new and value-added uses for those commodities, and to develop resource-saving practices for producers in the state. AURI was formed by the legislature back in 1987 as part of the Greater Minnesota Corporation. We were created as a 501c3 nonprofit. Essentially, we were established to be a non-governmental catalyst for value-added activity here in the state. We're a very unique resource for Minnesota. In fact, very few other states have anything even close to what Minnesota has in that regard. We are producer-driven. We are directed, we have a board of directors made up of a leadership of strong agricultural folks in the state. Those folks represent cooperatives, agribusiness, commodity groups, farm organizations, and also the legislature is represented on our board of directors. Essentially, our sole focus is on adding value to Minnesota agriculture. Basically taking the commodities that we grow, working with producers and existing businesses to help develop new uses, additional revenue streams for those products that are produced so well here in the state. We do that by providing technical assistance. Essentially, we're the research and development arm of small to medium-sized businesses in Minnesota. In most cases, the services that we provide come at no cost to the businesses that we work with, which the intention in which we believe provides our businesses with a competitive advantage. We also do analytical testing to determine the makeup of certain products and whether or not there is a market feasibility for those. Feasibility is a key thing that we work on as an organization. First of all, from a technical standpoint, can it be done? Can we make biomass pellets from crop residue? Can we make various plastics, for example, out of the starches or other agricultural residues? So we help determine if, in fact, it can be done. And then we also work in the area of market feasibility, wondering whether it should be done. There are many things that can be done with agricultural products, but if there's no market, no additional value added to those products, if no one will buy it, we essentially haven't done any good in that regard. So we make sure that both sides of that equation are looked at. We get in early, in most cases, in the project development stream, helping to determine if we should move a project forward, and we have the assistance to do that, but sometimes the best thing we can do is to actually identify opportunities that aren't such great opportunities and are able to actually steer folks away from going down the wrong path. Much of what we do, especially for those existing businesses and the startups, is proprietary. Essentially, they're trade secrets, so that's not anything that can be shared with other folks. On the flip side of that, we have broad impact initiatives. One of the things that we are able to do as a result of working with innovators and cutting-edge folks is recognize emerging opportunities. These initiatives help to identify those opportunities, help to expand the possibility of large-scale usage of the commodities that we grow. This is information that's available for folks in the states to utilize. Some examples include an oilseed study, looking at the processing capacity in the state and what the opportunities are. As a result of that, we actually helped several groups decide to move ahead with the production or the actual construction of additional oilseed refining capacity here in the state of Minnesota. So that's an example of a broad impact initiative. We also provide research and development assistance and experience to rural Minnesota. We do have laboratory facilities and staff that know how to operate them to help in the area of product development, process refinement. That assistance can be offered either in our laboratory facilities or on site, depending upon what the needs are and how we can best serve the clients. But then we also serve as a conduit to additional resources. We are a relatively small organization, so obviously we know that we can't be all things to all people and can't offer all the assistance necessary. But after the 15 years that we've been in operation, we have a pretty good idea of who else is out there and who can best serve that the need that the client has identified, that we've identified along with them. Also, as I mentioned, much of what we do is proprietary, but the things that are not, we work in various ways to try and get the information out to the folks who can benefit from them, including training sessions, forums, different informational meetings, helping to get producers acquainted with some of the opportunities that may be out there. You also have in your packet the newspaper that we put together on a quarterly basis called Ag Innovation News, which goes out to about 14,000 people, largely in the state of Minnesota. That's another means that we use to help get the word out about what's happening in value-added agriculture throughout Minnesota. We work with the farmers, farmer-owned cooperatives, small and medium-sized agri-processors, emerging rural businesses, but we also partner in mutually beneficial opportunities for moving ag commodities into new places. We partner with commodity and grower groups, private and public organizations, as well as state and federal agencies. It's an effort to obviously help maximize the resources that we have as well as the resources that they have and providing the assistance that is needed. To make a project feasible. As I mentioned, we have three offices throughout the state, Crookston, Marshall, and Waseca. We also have some laboratory facilities which are fairly unique in those locations, the meat laboratory in Marshall, which works on product development, process refinement, those sorts of things. Fats and oils lab, also located in Marshall. One of the key things that that facility has been involved in is in the development and the refinement of biodiesel blends for use in Minnesota. That's been a large research area for us, and it's something that we're very proud to have worked with, and we're proud to see the industry growing here in the state. A co-products utilization lab in Waseca is also a very unique facility which works with things such as co-processing waste. A great example would be the distiller screens left over from the ethanol making process that has been evaluated 100 different ways, including use as a renewable energy source for both the consumer and industrial end users. Huge area of opportunity in that regard, and we're very active in searching those opportunities out and working with folks who are trying to move those forward. And a product development kitchen located in Crookston, which works on product formulation and scale up, as well as nutritional labeling and those sorts of things for food-based applications. Some of the things that we believe are strengths of the organization are the fact that we're one of the only value-added programs of its kind in the country. There are value-added programs in other states, but very few offer hands-on expertise, laboratory facilities, and the types of things that are offered here in Minnesota. The technical assistance and feasibility is ongoing. There are clients that we have worked with through many different stages of product development and subsequent different product development needs that they have. In addition to meeting new folks, we continue to work with some of the folks we've worked with previously and with existing businesses in the state. One of the things that we also need to stress is that AURI's research is not a pure benchtop research. It's an applied research, taking the technology and taking the work that's been done in other places and applying it to real-world applications and trying to get it out into the world to utilize that technology in value-added product development. That's work that does not duplicate what is being done elsewhere. That's one of the concerns that folks have, is that there is a redundancy in services. I can assure you what AURI does differs from what the Department of Agriculture does, as well as from what the University of Minnesota does. We do collaborate quite frequently, so we think that we complement each other in what we do. An example of an interest that folks have in value-added agriculture, a minimum of 16 various states have contacted us to try and determine how they can implement something similar to AURI within their states. Everywhere from Florida to Hawaii, they've been very interested in what AURI does and how the services are provided, and are looking at the setting up the value-added programs in their state that they're utilizing some of AURI's information as a model for their own. Now that you know a little bit more about what we do, it's important for us to show that what we do has impact and has value for the state of Minnesota. In the past fiscal year, just shy of 15,000 hours of service was offered to projects in the past fiscal year. Those are specific projects that does not include some of the initial discussions with folks to determine if, in fact, there is a potential project. So with a staff of 14 full-time and 3 part-time, a lot of people are very busy working in value-added development. Again, in the past fiscal year, 245 projects received assistance from us. That pretty much is a good number on an annual basis. It's roughly 240, 250 projects that are being serviced at any given time. Now, to provide some feedback as to what our impact is, we conduct an annual survey of our clients. This is conducted by an independent university research firm. We send this out, to all of our clients and solicit feedback from them. We do have some numbers from about 49 of our respondents, so it's not even a full representation. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to get everyone to participate, but we still think these numbers show that the impact is there. In fact, as a result of those 49 projects, 197 new jobs were created by those AURI-supported projects last year. Those companies expect to invest more than $16 million in infrastructure as a result of those projects, and nearly 5,000 producers were directly impacted. Now, these aren't spin-off jobs or any jobs down the line. These are projects that directly impact producer investors, producer owners, farmers who are certainly have a vested interest in what happens in those value-added projects. A couple of the things that we think are most important to show, 50% of our clients received referral and networking assistance. Not only did they utilize our services, but we were able to direct them to other resources that were available. About 55% said their company saved money because of the fact that they worked with AURI. Nearly 40% increased their sales revenues as a result of the projects that they worked with us on, and about 60% avoided costs and mistakes. We certainly think that those figures show that there is value in the services that AURI provides, and that you know, we certainly believe that there's continued opportunity to assist with the value-added developments in Minnesota. At this point, I'd like to have Max Norris, our Director of Projects and Technology, talk a bit more about our programs and highlight some examples of the projects that we've worked with.
Thank you, Mr. Lemke. Mr. Norris, can you identify yourself for the record, and go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm Max Norris. I'm Director of Projects and Technology with AURI. Representative Dill and members of the committee, as we mentioned earlier, AURI continues to be a very adaptable and a flexible organization that has had to adapt to many changes. We believe we have successfully carved out a niche for the unique and innovative services we provide. To do so, we have developed programs to support value-added development that meets the needs of our clients without duplicating the efforts of others. These programs are the mechanisms through which our services are accessed. AURI's programs are designed to assist in the development of innovative, commodity-based products. They assist in helping businesses establish processes for producing value-added product. These programs are also used to promote the products developed with AURI assistance. Our programs are also established to help identify emerging opportunities and to bring products of processes to the marketplace, which is, by the way, the most important thing. After all, it's not enough just to develop a value-added product. We want to help these innovators make certain there is a market for their product and then attempt to help them reach that marketplace. As we mentioned earlier, 245 projects received assistance from AURI staff last year. I would like to highlight several of those projects that have resulted in significant achievements. As you are aware, Minnesota has made a commitment to the development of biodiesel within our state. In 2004, Farmers Union Marketing and Processing Association became the first to open a biodiesel refinery in Minnesota. This facility, located at Central Byproducts Processing Plant in Redwood Falls, produces 2.8 million gallons of biodiesel per year. They also, by the way, are providing the biodiesel for the short line that is in Redwood Falls, the railroad, and had the opportunity to host several months ago the opening of that utilization of biodiesel going into locomotives. AURI continues to work with them on process development and refinement. AURI has also worked with Minnesota's meat processing industry in the Federal State Marketing Improvement Program. This is an effort to connect small meat processors with markets for their offal, O-F-F-A-L. The things that we have great difficulty from time to time finding markets for and disposing of. There are markets for these byproducts, however, most small processors do not have enough value to reach these markets on their own. AURI has worked to help bring these processors together to supply enough volume, which will provide the small processor an additional revenue stream. Biorefining, which you may be aware of, is an innovative company. AURI has assisted and once developed into a cutting-edge company that exists today. Utilizing a patented process, biorefining is able to fractionate ag processing co-products into high-value components. The process could be used to create additional revenue streams for ag processors, including ethanol plants. As I'm sure most of you are aware, there are three major products that come out of an ethanol plant. It's ethanol, of course, carbon dioxide, and distiller's dry grain with solubles. And the utilization of the distiller's dry grain sometimes becomes an issue because of the value of the products in general. So from that standpoint, biorefining, and most recently, February 1 and 2 of this year, hosted the unit process to a number of folks like AURI, since we were involved in it, and also to a number of outside potential users of that technology. And essentially, what it amounts to is it's a unit process that is in the front end of an ethanol plant to where that you minimize the production of lower cost materials and you maximize the production of higher value materials that can be moved into the marketplace. Another innovative company that has created a real win-win situation is Mississippi Topsoil of Cold Springs, Minnesota. Topsoils utilize a computer-controlled composting system to turn arbor trimmings and poultry processing waste into premium compost and potting soil marketed throughout the state. Converting the waste from the Golden Plump processing plant into a saleable product adds value to a low-value ag-based product that was costing the processor money for disposal. The cost saving is good for Golden Plump, and their waste stream is a key ingredient in the premium compost. The last area that I will chat a little bit with you about is Pet Care Systems of Detroit Lake. They received various forms of assistance from AURI over the years, and that assistance includes process refinement, which has led to increased output of their wheat-based pet litters. I'm sure that all of you have probably seen, and if you are a cat fancier, you may even have purchased this material. It's coming from a side stream co-product out of the wheat area. This assistance has resulted in increased efficiency, greater volume of product produced. They currently use 18 to 20,000 acres of non-food grade wheat in their products. Those are just a few of the innovative projects that we have at AURI and that we have been involved in. There are many more similar projects that are achieving success and are contributing to the strengthening of the rural economy. We now know our time is limited, so I would like Edgar Olson to make some final points. Edgar?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee again. Although the budget cuts that have been sustained haven't changed the mission of AURI, the agency's mode of operation has very definitely changed. We have contributed a great deal of hours to projects, but we find ourselves in many examples of searching for grants and funds, which we do, and I think we've done quite well this year. We have a $1 million grant from USDA, another one from Excel, and numerous other smaller ones that we've had. A huge amount of this is takes a lot of effort and time. In the process also, we were forced to make a reduction of staff cuts, and we're now, at the present time, we have 14 full-time employees and 3 part-time staffers. And we've made sure that we've focused our efforts on our areas of the greatest impact. We have had to set priorities and to the center, and center around energy and energy co-products, commodity utilization, and the meat processing and product development. Despite the reduced resources, AURI and the need for AURI services has never been greater. As a result of the reduced state support, AURI is directed to seek funds elsewhere. And I mentioned some of those that we mentioned briefly, and I covered a few of those. And this has resulted in the budget of AURI, state funding, approximately one-third, and outside funding has been approximately two-thirds of that funding is what makes up our budget at the present time. I believe that AURI is a very unique and valuable resource to Minnesota. We are a market... We are market industry focused and producer oriented. To survive this long, AURI had to be adaptable and flexible. We've done what we will, and we've done what we had to do to continue to function in a way that maximizes our resources and best meets the needs of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Minnesota had great foresight when the legislature and agricultural leaders formed AURI. Even now, AURI remains a unique resource in Minnesota and throughout the country. AURI has actually become kind of the poster child of the value-added industry when you take a look at after what we went through to secure and were the top-ranked AIC for the Ag Innovation Center and got that USDA grant and were the top-ranked grant in the process. The biggest problem with most of these grants, and as you go through them, the money that comes in most of these grants has to be matched. And this is primarily where a huge portion or almost all of the state appropriations go to and go toward now at the present time is to provide that match or the leverage to get money from other sources. With that, members of the committee, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members? Representative Wagenius?
Thank you. This is new for me, so just help me understand this a little bit. As you are searching out opportunities for value added, I'm not quite sure which direction you're looking in, and maybe I'm getting mixed up because it's both. Is it you're just trying to use Minnesota's traditional crops more effectively, or are you looking for things that might be grown in Minnesota that might have a huge profit margin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it's all of the above. We're looking at resources that we can utilize in this area, and if we can add value to it at home, and we can add value to whatever, whether it's the production of energy, production of food, or whatever have you, once it's on the barge, once it's on the train or on the ship, you cannot add value to that product any longer. If we have to add that value, we have to do it here in Minnesota, and we take care of the freight disadvantage we have if it's shipped down the road by any source.
Representative Gaines.
Then, if that's the case, as a consumer who does a lot of shopping, let me make one suggestion. I was in the grocery store in my co-op yesterday, and looking at organic canola oil, and people are using more and more canola oil just because that's what you're supposed to do these days. And it turns out that the canola oil I buy that's organic costs me more than a fine imported olive oil.
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I'm going to defer to Max Norris, and he's the specialist in the oils and the foods area, and maybe he could enlighten us on that issue.
Mr. Norris?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as you probably are also well aware, while the Surgeon General of the United States has certainly proposed the use of an oil like canola, we do not have high volume of production within canola within our country, if you will. The majority of the canola comes out of Canada, and it does not come without some cost, if you will, from an importation standpoint. The other aspect of the thing, you spoke in terms of organic. In dealing with organic crops, one doesn't just obviously go out and plant a crop, harvest it next year, and now you have an organic crop. One must, to begin with, you must qualify your land that it is organic. It has not had pesticides. I believe the number is 4 or 5 years prior to that. Three, thank you. So from that standpoint, obviously, there is our input costs. There are extremely high levels of tracking costs that are associated with products that are coming out from an organic. So from that standpoint, I am not surprised that the price is higher than standard commodity oils that are in the marketplace today.
Representative Wagenius?
I'm sorry. I'm sure I wasn't clear. I didn't say standard oils in the marketplace. I'm saying it's higher than an imported olive oil of high quality that's also organic. So the price is enormously high. I mean, so if you're buying a quart of good olive oil that's imported from, well, Spain or from Italy, the prices are comparable. That's the price I was making, comparison I was making.
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I farm in the northern part of the state, and I can explain a little bit about the canola. Canola was, generally speaking, been a crop that, in a fairly cold climate crop, And it has to be also one that is, if I remember right, where you don't have a great deal of humidity. And the biggest disasters that have happened to the producers and the farmers that have raised canola in the last few years, and it used to be that I could drive down the road from my farm to town and I could see any number of canola fields, probably, you know, 10, 15 of them. They have disappeared because of the disease problems that we've had with canola, and to be able to maintain that crop and to maintain it at a profitable level. So the reason part of that is that is the fact that a lot of people had to discontinue growing canola, and the yields have got to the point where they were, you know, disaster levels. And because of that, the prices have escalated, and because it's been a short, you know, very huge shortfall of commodity. And most of the processors that did process, if we would have had the growth in the canola business that was evident in the way it was progressing 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I think you would have seen commodity, whether it was organic or regular, would have been a lot different level. But as we developed those crops, and as you, those crops, with canola is an old crop, but it was prone to diseases. And as it moved further south into the rainfall areas and the climates that had higher humidity and the dews, the disease just got the best of it.
Mr. Olson, is in Canada, is canola regulated like the wheat board has quotas? Is that, does canola fall under those same quotas by the Canadian Wheat Board?
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my ability, I don't think, if I remember the regulations, canola is not a regulated crop.
And so therefore,
it's a specialty crop treated just like any other.
So therefore, farmers in Canada can export the crop into the U.S. without hassle. Like, you know, they basically put them in jail, as I understand, up there if they try and send wheat out of the country.
Not necessarily, because there's a lot of trucks coming across the line, and a lot of those have wheat on board, and there are those deals. It's the problem is between the producer. Is the producer trying to achieve the sale directly by himself, or is he selling through a marketing order through the agency or the wheat board? That was the problem, that whether they were trying to sell outside the wheat board, and I think the wheat board has kind of got a monopoly on some of the crops out there, and some of that's as a result. But the biggest problem that they've had too as well is sunflower is another crop that very similar to what she said. If you had the sunflower crop and the crop was spread apart and you didn't have, you know, fields that were matching or touching each other, and there were 15 and 20 miles between fields, you didn't have much of a disease problem. But once you got these crops and you got the intensity and you got more and more sunflowers, the same thing happened to sunflowers as happened to canola. So that's the best, my best explanation I can give you on that issue.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chairman, and to the AURI. Your Ag Innovation News talks about biodiesel being used on the Minnesota Prairie Line, about that 500,000 gallons. I'm wondering if anybody from, or have you been in contact with those proponents of the North Star Corridor train, potentially, that would use biodiesel, potentially. I think I've heard 20 million gallons they could use annually for the biodiesel of the North Star Corridor. Some of its representatives from rural areas might need a prompt to support that train. And it has stumbled for several years around this body, and now it doesn't even go to and through St. Cloud. So I'm wondering, how do you assert yourselves as AURI into the conversation to potentially making biodiesel use reality for North Star if it gets to that point?
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I will defer that to Max Norris. He's worked with that area, and he had some contact quite heavily with the biodiesel industry and what their efforts are. Many times, you know, the fuel that is used on any entity, whether it's that railroad or the one that you talked about, that's primarily in that, you know, in the farm and agricultural areas. A lot of those answers have to come from here in St. Paul. And they, you know, and some of that encouragement maybe that would have to come from here. we can tell them what's available, we can tell them what the product is, how good the product is, and make sure that it's environmentally sound and environmentally that it is a benefit to our society. And with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Norris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I know for a fact that there have been some discussions out of the biodiesel industry with the railroads. Let me just put it in that that perspective. Specifically, there has been discussion on exactly your question. The outcome at this point, I have no idea. If we go back and look at basically what occurred around Redwood in the short line down there, we had a lot of internal activity going on with that short line that had the entrance. It was perhaps somewhat of an easier sell. On the other hand, as we begin to set the foundation for biodiesel in our country and biodiesel in Minnesota, we started with a short line. Obviously, we're going to continue with moving products of this nature into other modes of transportation. That will be certainly the things that we deal with. I just have a note here that is some items that came out of a conference I had the opportunity to visit last week. It was a national biodiesel conference. John Deere, for instance, looking at farm equipment and things of that nature, made a commitment. They made a commitment to the industry that they will provide biodiesel at a B5 level in every tractor they sell. So coming from that standpoint, the National Biodiesel Board is working with the railroads, if you will, and those sites, and some of the local folks within Minnesota are working with discussions with the folks of the corridor that you're speaking of. It's a beginning. Unfortunately, it's not an end with any major results at this time.
Representative Junkie.
To that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it's a good idea. Draft the amendment up when that bill comes through. I'm sure you'll get the support, hopefully, of this committee and ag people around and environmentalists and others. And the main reason that short line, the way I understand it, they're using it is they've got Caterpillar engines in who are warranting biodiesel and General Electric at this point, which has engine locomotive engines, diesels in most of the other trains in the state, are not warranting it yet. But I'll guarantee you that if we put that mandate in, and Caterpillar is the only one then that has an engine warranted, I bet you real quick GE and others will have the warranties on their engines to bid for those projects. And in fact, that would help open it up for the rail industry across the state to use it. So get the amendment drafted up. Don't mess around.
And there you have it. Any other members with questions for the AURI this morning? There being none, thank you very much for your presentation and your good work, and we appreciate your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, members of the committee. I appreciate the chance to tell you a little bit more about AURI. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Members, the quorum is present at this time, and we will... Representative Pennis, have you reviewed the minutes from the meeting, the minutes before us?
Yes, I have.
And you'd like to move those minutes, Representative Pennis? Any addition or corrections to the minutes? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Next on our agenda will be Dr. Hartman from the Board of Animal Health, and I think most are familiar with Dr. Hartman. And Dr. Hartman, when you are ready to proceed, do so. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. I've handed three things out to you, and I'll just show those to you now. The first one is this blue and green brochure. That's a brochure explaining what we do at the Board of Animal Health. Secondly, a brochure that talks about one of our major disease control programs in Minnesota, our voluntary Yoni's disease control program. And then lastly, a copy of our annual report. And this is a report that we submit to the legislature each year detailing the accomplishments of the Board of Animal Health. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here this morning and explain the governor's recommendations for the Board of Animal Health's budget. And this first slide I'm going to put up just is the agency overview for the Board of Animal Health. And you can see that our current budget for this biennium is $5,606,000, or $2,803,000 per year. The governor's recommendation is for a slight increase to that budget, and the purpose of that increase is to pay for the increased lease costs that we will have when we move to a new building with the Department of Agriculture to the Department of Health. That would be $156,000 in the first year of the biennium and $158,000 in the second year. So it's overall a 5.6% increase in our budget. A couple of other things I'll point out on the agency interview or overview. Under the expenditures by fund, the statutory appropriation special revenue, what that money is fees that we collect from deer and elk herds for their inspection fees. So we collect fees when we do inspections annually from those herds, and the fees are $10 per animal to a maximum of $100 per herd what we collect. The other thing I'll draw your attention to is the line just below that, the federal. What that is funding that we get from the federal government in cooperative agreements for our disease control programs, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But this year we got $924,000. We're projecting for the next biennium that for the whole biennium a little over $1.6 million in that form.
And Mr. Harmon, is that when you do contract work for them in your labs, things of that nature, or is that give me some information on that?
Mr. Chairman, no, most of that funding comes directly to the board for to support the disease control programs. These are national disease control programs, so we may be, as an example, with Yoni's disease, we're trying to control this disease nationwide. So USDA has made the commitment that new funding that they get, that they split with the states to support so that the states so that these disease control programs can move ahead. So it would be used for personnel. It may be used for technology. It may be much of what we use that money for is money that goes directly to farmers to support to do testing for some of the disease control programs. Because these are national control programs, we work very closely with USDA and a division of USDA called Veterinary Services. They have an office here in St. Paul and have 27 employees, so they're very similar in size to the Board of Animal Health. So not only are they providing cooperative agreement funding to us, but they also have provide employees to do the work here in Minnesota. I mentioned before that we're looking at $1.6 million in cooperative agreements, and that money comes to us for a number of disease control programs, but I've listed a few here: avian pneumovirus in turkeys, chronic wasting disease in deer and elk, Yoni's disease and BSE in cattle, and scrapie, a disease very similar to BSE that is in sheep, and then some funding for emergency management as well. What I'd like to do then is, our budget is pretty simple, so I thought I'd go on and talk about some of our major programs and what federal funding we're getting there, and then some of the accomplishments of those programs as well. The first one I'll start with is our voluntary Yoni's disease program. If you remember, Yoni's disease is a chronic disease of cattle, and it affects probably more than half of the dairy herds in Minnesota, as well as in the country. That voluntary program was authorized by the legislature in 1997, so we're into about 8 years of this program. I want to draw your attention to the fact that Minnesota has one of the most successful programs in Yoni's disease control in the country. This is a national control program. It's voluntary. In Minnesota, we've been able to get about over 1,400 of our dairy and beef herds involved in this program. And as far as the federal funding that comes to us for this program, if you include money that goes directly to the veterinary diagnostic lab to offset the cost of testing for this disease, the USDA is providing over $1 million to Minnesota to fuel this program. Another disease program, or well, actually it's a control program that we have here in Minnesota. If you remember, a couple of years ago, chronic wasting disease was kind of high on our radar screen. We found chronic wasting disease in the free-ranging white-tailed deer in Wisconsin, and they're still fighting that battle over there. We also found two elk herds in Minnesota that were infected with chronic wasting disease. When that occurred, the regulation of these deer, captive deer and elk herds in Minnesota moved from the Department of Natural Resources over to the Board of Animal Health, and we have about 756 of these deer and elk herds that we inspect annually. And I mentioned that the producers are paying a fee for those inspections, $10 per animal up to $100 total for a herd. That program is going very well. We're having good success at finding these farms and getting them enrolled in the chronic wasting disease surveillance. And we, the good news is we haven't found any more chronic wasting disease in Minnesota in the captive animals as well as in the wildlife. DNR just got done with their hunter kill survey for last fall. And they did, I think it was about 13,000 samples for that, and they didn't find any positives either. So we're feeling pretty good that if there is any chronic wasting disease in the wild in Minnesota, it's at a very, very, very low level. And for our chronic wasting disease, our deer and elk programs in Minnesota, we received $50,000 from the federal government to support that. Another disease that affects turkeys in Minnesota that's a major program right now is avian pneumovirus. It's a highly contagious disease, fairly similar to avian influenza in that, that affects the turkeys in Minnesota. It affects over half of our turkey flocks in Minnesota and is of real concern, mostly because we're the only state that this disease has persisted in. It was first found in Colorado, caused problems out there, but they were able to get rid of it. It has been in Minnesota now for some years. We've been fighting it. It has spilled over into Wisconsin, Iowa, and I think North and South Dakota, but they've been able to eliminate it from those states. So we're working with the federal government on this to see if there's a way that we can feasibly eliminate it from the turkey population in Minnesota. And if we did, from the turkey population in the United States. Minnesota got $560,000 from the federal government for that project. And that, it's just in the very beginning stages now of seeing if we can use vaccine and biosecurity to move this disease out of the state. After we found the BSE-positive cow in Washington last Christmas, we refer to that as the cow that stole Christmas, we've enhanced our surveillance for BSE in the United States. And if you can see from this slide, our national targets were 268,000, and our target number of samples here in Minnesota was 10,000. We've gone over our target in Minnesota, so we have a very successful surveillance going on, and we're getting close to the national targets as well. And I just I impress upon people that this is a big job, because 268,000 samples, if they were just blood samples, wouldn't be too big a deal, but these are, you actually have to get a sample of the brain from these cows, and it's on a targeted population of animals, so these are downer animals or animals showing symptoms of the disease. So I think it's a testament to USDA and Minnesota's efforts that we've been able to reach those targets. And again, the good news is we haven't found any additional cases of BSE. The last thing I wanted to talk about was our National Animal Identification System. When we found that positive cow in Washington, And there was a great concern that if we found another one of these positives, or if we had a disease outbreak of some kind, that we have an imperfect animal identification and tracking system in the United States right now. As diseases such as brucellosis and tuberculosis, where we had good identification on livestock, have been eliminated, our system for identifying animals and tracking the movement of them has diminished. The funding for it has decreased. So the Secretary of Agriculture said that a national animal identification system is a high priority, and we've started working on that. We're working very closely with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the USDA, the university, especially the Extension Service, and the livestock industry in Minnesota to implement an animal identification system in Minnesota. And we were able to get $434,000 from USDA to implement the first phase of this project, and that is to identify all the premises in Minnesota that have livestock on them and give them a national premise ID number. We recently sent out a mailing to 35,000 livestock producers, and in there was a card that would allow them to register with us and get this premise ID number. In the first week, we've gotten over 4,000 of those cards back with people voluntarily registering. It's a voluntary program. If you choose to register your premise, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Another big part of this program, what we've done is we've worked very closely with the Extension Service. We've trained them on the message we want them to give to livestock producers about animal ID, and they're out at smaller meetings then passing the word on. There's a lot of concern on producers' part that the burden of this program doesn't fall totally on them for the costs. And there's also a concern that the information we're collecting is not being distributed in ways that will harm them. So we're trying to get the message out about the disease. The last slide I have is just a listing of other programs that we have for disease control in Minnesota. I didn't want you to think that's all we did with your $3 million. These are a partial list of other things, activities that go on in the Board of Animal Health, and those are detailed more in this annual report. Representative Pettis, you probably remember anthrax up in your area. That's something that is a success story. We haven't had any trouble with that for a couple of years because of all the vaccination that's going on there. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Harmon. I'm interested in hearing something, if it's going to have any effect. I've been reading recently that there's going to be a new effort to bring cattle, live cattle or cattle in from Canada into the United States, and I would assume that would include Minnesota.
Correct.
And how will that affect your group and your cost of operation and us as the consumers?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could just outline what USDA is proposing for opening the border to cattle and livestock products. When they found BSE in Canada, we closed the border to all ruminants. So ruminants are cattle, sheep, goats, cervidae or deer and elk. And so those animals couldn't come in at all, nor any of their products. The proposal is to, not just for Canada, but for all countries, to open the border to specific things from countries that are considered minimal risk for BSE. So countries like Great Britain wouldn't be qualified to bring animals in based on that minimal risk. So what they're trying to say is for free trade within the world, that we have to recognize that some countries like Canada, the United States, and others have a very low risk for this carrying this disease, whereas other countries have a much higher risk. What this would do then is for minimal risk countries, if they meet that classification, it would allow them to export cattle that are under 30 months of age into the United States to go directly to a feedlot and then directly to slaughter under controlled circumstances, or go directly to slaughter. So it would be animals, beef cattle that are under 30 months of age going to a feedlot or going directly to slaughter. In the case of sheep and goats, it would allow them to come in if they were under a year of age for the same purpose, directly to slaughter or to a feedlot for further feeding. And then in the case of cervidae, it would allow them to come into the country if they meet our chronic wasting disease requirements. And then as far as meat goes, I think that's maybe a little controversial yet, but I think the, what the rule says is it would allow meat to come in if it's from cattle, if it's from those animals that are under 30 months of age. Now, you ask how that would impact the Board of Animal Health. I don't think it would have a direct impact on our organization. And as far as the my understanding of it and the science of it, I don't think it greatly increases our threat of having any problems with BSE in the United States. Number one, these animals that are coming in are all under 30 months of age. And any animals that are slaughtered in the United States, precautions are taken so that the specified risk materials or the parts of the body that contain this prion are eliminated from the human food supply. So there should be no risk that way.
All right, thank you. Members, questions? Boy, are you lucky.
I am.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hartman, for coming today and giving us the information on the Board of Animal Health. We have nothing else on the agenda for today. On Tuesday, February 15th, we'll be hearing from the MPCA and the OEA, same type of presentations. And unless there is other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.